Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the A-List with me, Jennifer Neely. This is one in a series of special shows celebrating the 25th anniversary of Peach Pit Press. Joining me for this program is Christopher Breen, who has wrote about the Macintosh since the latter days of the Reagan administration for such publications as Mac User, Mac Week, and Mac World. He currently writes, I think we're going to have to mute a line here. Hang on one second.
Okay.
And Chris is obviously on the line. We'll bring him in just a second. But joining me is, again, Christopher Breen. He's written about the Macintosh since the latter days of the Reagan administration for such publications as Mac User, Mac Week, and Mac World. He currently writes MacWorld's Daily Tips, as well as Game Room, the magazine's monthly games column. When not engaged in journalistic pursuits, Chris works as a professional musician in the San Francisco Bay Area, where I am delighted to join and welcome to the A-List. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I'm thrilled that you could be here. Looks like you're in the Santa Cruz Mountains area.
Yeah, that's where I call home. I'm actually on vacation now in the Santa Barbara area, and it's nice here, too.
Hey, wherever you can get some sunshine, that's nice.
Yeah.
So I hear that you are the go-to gadget guy. Do you think that's a fair representation of your work?
That's one of the things I do. I was the first person to write a book about an iPod when the thing first came out. And everyone thought it was a ludicrous idea that, first of all, you had this very expensive MP3 player at $400, and it had about one button on it and a wheel and a couple of other cookie things. And the idea that anybody would want to write a book about such a ridiculous little gadget that was sure to fail was surprising. And it turns out that it did okay. So I have since followed that up, writing about the iPod Touch and the iOS and iPads and iPhones. And of course, I write a lot about the Macintosh and Apple as well.
And I love you for that, because as a Mac user, we can never have enough Mac knowledge. What I think is interesting is when you go through that process and in terms of testing a product, I went through that same thing. Am I really going to buy an iPod? I ended up buying a Mini, and I think those are probably going to be as rare someday as anything else that Mac tried and decided to ditch. But I wonder what your process entails for trying out or testing things so that you feel like you have the authority as a journalist and author to write about them.
Yeah, I try to approach products as a normal consumer. And so a lot of times if I get a new device in, whether it's an iPod or an iPhone or the iPad comes out or so, whatever the gadget is, I sit down with it and I try not to approach it as somebody who spent a lot of time playing with gadgets, but rather a normal person who's going to pick this thing up, open the box, and say, how do I get done what I need to get done with this device? And with Apple products, it's reasonably easy to do that because they are intuitive. If I'm confused about using something, it generally means the design is a little off or I'm just having a bad day. So I try to go back, and then I show it to other people, too, who are not geeks. I'll show it to my wife. I'll show it to my daughter. If I'm around my family, I'll show it to my mother and my sisters and let them play with it for a while and just watch what they do with the device and see if it makes sense to them. So that's it in terms of approachability. And then I start digging into the geekier elements of it. Is there a better option than what's been presented to me? Is there an easier way to use this? Is it Apple pushing a proprietary technology because they're going to make more money from it, and maybe it's not such a great deal for consumers, that kind of thing.
So, taking the devil's advocate side of this, since you do write so much about the Macintosh, is there anything, and I mean, this has been, and probably, in large part to where Steve Jobs is at his life, it's been from all sources that I hear, a crazy release year for Macintosh. I don't think I can remember, you know, ever seeing so many products rolled out on such a different schedule. And maybe you feel differently about that, but I feel like there's a lot of products out there at a lot of times that we don't normally see Mac products. And I'm wondering, you know, to that point you said towards the end, is Mac pushing anything out for what you feel like is a particular reason? Do you feel like there's anything that's not really adding value or could possibly wait or use some extra time in development?
You know, Apple is getting theirs while the getting is good. They're doing very well right now. And I think they're trying to ride the crest of that wave. You know, they were beleaguered for so long that they were releasing really great technology and people weren't buying enough of it. And suddenly, I think with the iPod that it started that things started to catch on and people started to think, oh, you know, Apple stuff is really quite good. At this point, Apple still tends to do things because they believe they're the right things to do. They've had a history of pushing the envelope in a number of ways, that they'll remove ports before the rest of us are ready for them to do that, or they'll change connection methods. When, for example, they got rid of the floppy port, so floppy disk died before a lot of us were ready for it. We're still using it, but they said, no, that's not where it's going, and they added USB when we're using other things. I think that continues today. If you look at a product like Final Cut Pro X, which is their new professional editing suite, they've removed a lot of the features that pros really want. But Apple sees the future of video being different. So at the same time, they're going to make some people mad who relied on their past technology, but they kind of feel like they know what's best. And some people describe that as being very innovative. Other people consider it to be arrogant, that Apple knows best and by gosh, you're going to follow them or get off the train and go buy a PC instead.
So, you know, we've seen adoption of, you know, the Mac in general go through the, well, I mean, for the percentages that we've seen Mac versus PC, when we come to, you know, what people are relying on to get their work done is one of the maybe ways we can more easily define adoption of Mac products. Do you feel like, you know, I kind of have the feeling that, you know, the price point of some of the smaller products and then the usability was a great introduction to how and why there are Mac people, because I remember interviewing Bob Levitis, who's a Wiley author, and he had said, you know, I used the iPhone and it just made my life, it improved my life, and that's why I wanted to write about it, and this is why, blah, blah, blah. And I'm curious what your take would be, if you would say something that bold, or if you feel like, as a journalist, that's not really your role, or you know, expand on that.
I try not to be an Apple fanboy. I really like their stuff, and I buy their stuff, but I try not to be blind to their faults. And I do think if you can step back and kind of look at the way you used to do things a couple of years ago and the way you do things now based on the kind of technology that Apple provides, it does make your life easier. So, you know, on the one hand, I try to be critical of Apple, but sometimes you can be so critical that you kind of lose the point that maybe this product was not designed for me. For example, there's some OS X Lion that's just come out. There are some features in there that make no sense to me at all. I mean, I understand that Apple has this great concept of bringing some of the interface elements of the iOS into the Mac OS, and so they change the direction of scrolling just because. You know, and to me that is capricious. If I'm using a mouse, that makes no sense to me whatsoever. If I'm using a touchpad, maybe so. But so it's kind of a tough balance, you know, where you try to be a normal person, but at the same time you're a geek and you kind of get what they've been doing there. And as to Bob's point, I do think some of this stuff hinges the way you do things. When the iPad first came out, a lot of people looked at it and said, what am I going to do with this thing? It's not a laptop, and it doesn't have the capabilities of a laptop, so I can't replace my laptop with it. Is it really just a big iPod Touch? And I think a lot of people use that to dismiss the iPad. honestly, there's nothing wrong with it being a big iPod Touch. The iPod Touch is a cool little device, except its screen is too small for doing things like reading books and playing big games and using it as interfaces for musical instruments and that sort of thing. So having that real estate is a big advantage. And now I've found that I do a lot of stuff on my iPad that I never thought I would. It's a great companion in the car for my daughter when we go on road trips. I tend to carry the thing wherever I go. I get up in the morning, I check my email on it and do some web surfing. And if there's nothing really exciting happening, I go back to sleep. And I can't do that with my desktop computer because by that time I've gotten up, I've had my coffee, and I can't go back to bed. So the iPad allows me to get more sleep. And that, in a very fundamental way, that's changed my life.
Well, that's a really great way of putting it, and I love I talked with Steve Krug yesterday and Robin Williams the day before, and Robin actually, the way she explained the scrolling, because I've been trying really hard, I'm using Lion on all my machines now, and when she explained it as, you know, using your finger on the iPad and iPhone, it suddenly for some reason clicked for me, and it's much and that explains for me why it's a lot easier to deal with it on my trackpad than when you introduce the mouse. When you introduce the mouse, for me, it really just it becomes counterintuitive, but I'm really trying to not change the settings and just go with the flow and try to retrain myself, but I agree, it's definitely a mind shift, and you know that was one of the ones where I was like, where is this coming from? Because it wasn't clear to me until Robin pointed it out. So that was really helpful. And then Steve, from a usability standpoint, talked about that yesterday. And it's interesting you brought it up as a journalist and someone who's reviewing gadgets and talking about and monitoring trends. And speaking of trends, you know, there's certainly a lot around Apple that is trend worthy. You know, I mean, I don't know how many times on Twitter or whatever I'm on where I feel like I'm either seeing a lot of repetition about a particular product and usually boasting about a functionality or it being used in a particular way, especially around photo sharing, I feel like, because of the great, you know, little cameras that are in all of these machines. Are there any trends, having followed Apple or Macintosh for some time, that surprise you or bother you?
Let's see. I think as somebody who really likes to geek around with a computer when I'm not writing to sort of general public, it does bother me that Apple seems to be dumbing down some of the power features. I think that Final Cut Pro X is an example of that. That they, and from a business point, it makes sense. I mean, it makes much more sense for them to send 10 million copies of these to sort of prosumers and video editors who are starting now and going on into the future than it does to try to please 10,000 people that are working in Hollywood and have been for the past 20 years. But I do think that sometimes Apple strives to be so user-friendly that it's almost afraid of getting in and doing kind of the dirty work when a video editor needs to get into very precise editing, and it's difficult. It's a difficult job, and it's a difficult process, and it's difficult software to use. I think Apple is tending to shy away from those difficulties now, that it really is trying to shoot for the common person. And the plus side of that is it's granting an enormous amount of power to these people. So if I, with a good quality HD camcorder or a few of them, have some talent and get it together, I could actually make some really brilliant-looking stuff using a program like Final Cut Pro X. But again, once you sort of hit that pro level where the top people are doing it, then I think that Apple may be saying, but sayonara to some of those folks, at least for now, until they get that stuff going. In terms of surprise, I think I followed Apple for so long, just how popular they are now, that pretty much whatever they touch turns to gold. And I think we've seen, you know, I fully expected them to be a leading computer at some point because the stuff was just so good. I thought eventually people are going to catch on. This is going to be good. The fact that they've been able to turn some industries on their head the music industry, not the movie and TV industry yet, but that may be coming, and certainly the cellular phone industry. These are long-time industries that are really entrenched. They have a lot of power and a lot of money. And to see Apple be able to come in there and offer something that seems essentially like a Trojan horse, that's like, oh, look, we're just going to give you this little device that will make things better. These companies latch onto it because it is better, and they think, oh, well, what kind of threat could Apple be? And then 2 years down the line, suddenly you find that Apple has an enormous amount of power and can call the shots with the music industry and cell phone industry. So that trend, I think, is interesting to me. It will be more interesting to see how far Apple thinks it can go and what kind of areas it can get into and have that kind of control.
Interesting. Well, part of this year has seen the real reemergence in a lot of ways of Steve Jobs as sort of front and center of all of this. And those of us that follow this industry are all too aware of the sort of cult of Steve Jobs, love him or hate him. He is brilliant at what he does. Any thoughts on that in terms of, his role and, the team that he has in place around him if he were suddenly to disappear? Do you think Apple would be, producing the hits, hit after hit after hit, the way that they are now? I mean, I feel like you have a particular ability to kind of tell us what his role as both an innovator and leader is versus other people. You cover this as a journalist. From a journalistic point of view, what is his value, I guess, to the company if he were to leave for whatever reason as the top dog?
Yeah. Steve's question is an interesting one. He's he has a unique position in the tech industry, and a couple of people share it. I think Larry Ellison probably is the other big one, where he's daddy. He's big daddy, and he's not the very nice daddy. And when you bring something to daddy that displeases him, you are going to hear about it. He's, on the one hand, he can team build like nobody's business and inspire people to do great work. But that work had better be great, or daddy's going to get you in trouble, and nobody wants to get in trouble with daddy. So he demands of Apple that things that come out of Apple are spectacular. He wants everything to be a hit. In terms of Wall Street and the general perception of Steve Jobs, I think that they believe that if there is no Steve Jobs, there is no Apple. And I don't think that's the case. Should Steve disappear tomorrow, I think Apple's stock would drop significantly. And then after a couple of weeks, it'll probably bounce back when reality sets in and realizes that, again, Steve Jobs is a difficult guy. He's had this team of people around him pretty much since he's come back to Apple, so it's been about 10 years. They've been able to put up with Steve, which is not easy, and he's been able to put up with them, and that's not easy either because they have to deliver spectacular work. So you've got people who know what they're doing, who understand the Apple way. They've kind of got that Apple DNA in them. So they can carry on and do this thing. I also believe strongly in Apple's ability to purchase very large whiteboards. And that means somewhere locked away behind 75 layers of security, there's a room with an enormous whiteboard in it that has Apple's plan sketched out on for the next at least 2 years and probably five. Because it isn't like Steve Jobs wakes up in the morning and thinks, what we really need is the world's greatest coffee maker, and then issues that order, and then the next day they have the coffee maker.
Absolutely.
They know what's coming down the line. So if Steve disappeared tomorrow, I think anybody betting on Apple would say, we've got a good 2 years of quality stuff that's going to come out. Things are going to keep on. At that time, Wall Street's jitters are going to calm down and people will realize, Apple really can carry on and do this. And again, I think there's a lot in the company that makes them want to deliver fantastic stuff, whether Steve is there to get them in trouble or not.
Interesting what it'll be like someday when there's a shift, like that, because, those personalities of whether you want to think of them as brilliance or not, you know, the quirky personalities of people that tend to be dynamically brilliant can be very difficult, and it'll be interesting to see how that progresses over time. We'll all learn as we go, I suppose. Do you ever have the ability to interview Steve Jobs? I'm curious about that.
No, and I would be terrified to.
Would you?
A friend of mine was in California, and he used to be with eBay, and so he has connections to Steve Jobs, and he said, you know, we're going to have Steve and his wife over for dinner. Would you like to come? I said, absolutely not. I think I would get the stink eye of Steve on me, and I understand that's really hard to wash off. And so I like observing him from afar. I'm not sure that I'd ever really want to sit down and talk to the guy. Diminutive as he is, he just terrifies me.
So he seems to sort of choose the journalists for whom he wants to talk to when he's releasing things. So Kara Swisher, who's been on this program before, and Walt Mossberg. How do you think that process happens, or can you give us any insight into who gets to and has the, you know, for lack of a better term, the balls to interview a guy like Steve? Steve Jobs.
Yeah, it's based entirely on the outlet. So David Pogue used to work for Macworld, and he was the back page columnist. He did some other stuff, and then he got his gig at the New York Times. And so I was talking to him, and I said, so how has it changed since you were at Macworld and now that you're at the New York Times? And he says, it's completely different. But now Apple will answer my calls, and now Apple will call me, and now I can talk to Steve Jobs if I want to. So, you know, Walt gets in, and David gets in, and there are a handful of people that get early looks at things from Apple, and then an even smaller list that they're allowed to talk to Steve. And it's because of the outlets that they represent. So the Wall Street Journal, Apple is trying to reach out to the broadest range of people as possible, as readers as possible. So outlets like Macworld, you know, we're to Apple are considered an industry publication. And so, you know, our readers already know what's going on with Apple, and they believe. So they don't need us for that. But they do need to reach out to, you know, the mom and pops and the people in the disc community and everybody else. So that's why you'll see stories in the USA Today and Wall Street Journal and New York Times, maybe the LA Times, for that kind of access. And it's all about PR. Apple's PR is second to none in terms of control and being smart about it. So, you know, I don't resent anybody getting an interview with Steve. I understand how it works, and that's fine. I mean, it's smart PR on Apple's part.
And in a lot of ways, it really does make your reviews of new products more pure, I guess, in a sense. I mean, when I was at Columbia, my ethics in journalism professor, who's passed now, would have rolled over thinking, you know, jockeying to actually interview a CEO would be an important thing, but it is these days sometimes, and it does keep us more focused on, you know, the broader picture other times. So I think, you know, either way, you can have there are advantages either way, I suppose.
It's an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, it is.
I agree with you. I'm trained as a musician, so, you know, I have musician ethics, which are different. but I do sometimes, you know, when you see certain people getting advanced copies of things or product or sneak peek, or they get to talk to Steve, ethics does come into it, because you wonder, well, you know, I tend to look at these reviews and think, well, you know, how willing are they to risk the wrath of Apple? And if there's something that's bad about this product, are they going to say, this is terrible, and risk losing their access?
Right.
And so I have a real hard time with exclusives for a number of reasons, and it isn't necessarily Apple, but it's any company that says, oh, look, we'll give you a sneak peek, you know, with the implication that you're going to do right by us, and I can't do that as a reviewer. You know, I if something's bad. So we, you know, we tend to turn down that sort of stuff because it's just, you do enter into that ethical minefield. And then plus your readers start questioning, well, what, you know, what's the trade-off? What do you get out of this? And so I'd just rather not go there.
And I love that because I think, you know, one of the key things that you said earlier was handing the product to your daughter, to your wife. I know that when the iPad came out, you know, because I, you know, I'm a social media management consultant, I always have to at least appear to have the newest thing and definitely am an early adopter anyway, so I love having new products. So I got, you know, the iPad, the first one, the day it came out, and my mother told my sister, and my sister said, of course, Jennifer would have to have the newest thing to have it, and that wasn't really the point. The point is that it's a professional thing, and I actually enjoy it and, you know, wanted to see what it would do. But what changed for me was when I went to go visit my family and I hand the thing to my mom, she found the Netflix app, which was already, you know, had all my sign-in stuff, and she starts picking movies, and her life, like, in that moment changed, and she has not, her birthday is coming up, she's not stopped talking about the iPad ever since, and I'm like, don't worry about it, I'll go for your birthday, but she's just, you know, it was incredible to see, and my sister's resistance to even touch it, she just has no interest, and I think there's something about that, you know, oh, it's a geeky thing, I don't really need, you know, and they live in, you know, a part of the world where, you know, technology is not all around them, and it's not what they do for a living. So it was interesting to see the difference in their just personality in terms of approach to product and that sort of thing, because I feel like, you know, part of, you talked about earlier PR, part of Apple's PR and not having, you know, not putting an emphasis on social media is letting the product speak for itself, which, you know, in most cases is a good thing, it seems. So, you know, I don't know what your thoughts are about that, but I think that is, you know, I think that's kind of an experience that we all share for early adopters is, you know, the joy of seeing the product in other people's hands, which you could lose if you include that in a review and you have special
right.
access.
My mother's husband is 101 years old, and actually I'm here with him now. And,
wow, congratulations. That's amazing.
So it was before his 101st birthday, about a month before, and I put an iPad in his hands and fired up iBooks. And, you know, he has a hard time seeing, and so you can change the font size. So we made it a bit bigger and sat him down with a Dick Francis book, and I didn't see the iPad again for 3 days. And he's never touched it before. And, I mean, and that's the kind of thing where you see that, you know, yes, as a geek, I think this is really cool and I can do this and this and this. But when you see something like that, that fundamentally changes this man's life because he's run out of large print books at the local library and they're very expensive to buy. But I can just download anything from the iBookstore, put it on there, make the type big, and he's happy as a clam. And so,
oh, that's so neat.
Yeah, it's a great story, and that's again where you see fundamental change in something that to the rest of it seems like, oh yeah, well, yeah, but we had Kindles. The Kindles do this better, they have this feature, they do that. Forget it. I mean, the fact that a 100-year-old man can now read a book where he couldn't before is life-changing.
Yeah, it absolutely is. That is a great story. I'm so happy that you shared that. That's great. You know, we talked earlier about what I said about Bob Levitis, Dr. Mac, and the iPhone changing his life. We're all waiting to see if a new iPhone is coming out and when. You know, I'm curious what your thoughts are on when we might see a new iPhone and what we could hope to see in it and what you hope to see in it.
Okay. Let's see. The current – today's rumors as of, 12:29 p.m. are that because it changes minute to minute –
I know.
We'll see it in the fall. Normally, the new iPhones will come out in the summer. So if this were typical, we would see one now, and we haven't. So probably the fall. They want to sell enough of these things in the holidays, so they won't be late in the holidays. So certainly it will be before Thanksgiving. Apple traditionally does an iPod event in September. I don't think they want to muddle the message by doing that. So maybe, let's say, October. What will it be? It will be faster because it always is. It will be thinner because it always is. It will have more storage because it always does. The cameras will probably be better. They've mm-hmm. the camera on the back is pretty good now, but if they could make it a little better, and the one on the front they could make better. Screen's already high resolution. I think they're going to change the antenna setup because of the grip problems they had in the past. A lot of it's going to have to do with the iOS. These are going to be new features that are part of the basic operating system, so that it functions a little differently than it has in the past, notifications on the home screen and that kind of thing. What else do I want it to do? I don't know. What I would like to do is do financial transactions, and I think that's where Apple's going to make its next huge pile of money, that the iPhone and devices like it will become your credit card instead of you having to carry around a credit card. And you'll be able to purchase things based on your location and what you can scan into your phone or what you can bump into your phone by financial transactions.
So that brings up something kind of interesting, and I'm not sure that you cover this area, so I don't expect you. If you can't answer it, just tell me. But, you know, I saw Le Web, 2010 or 2009 when Jack Dorsey premiered the Square app, you know, and there have been others since where, you know, it makes your phone into, basically a conduit to making a transaction, but you're talking about the phone actually going the next step and actually being a transactional device. And I know that I've experienced that with some of the apps, and maybe you have too, where, you know, I've scanned in all my club cards, so I don't have to carry my club cards around. They just scan the barcode, and I'm good. Anything like that that you feel like that you're using right now that kind of gives you an indication that they could, you know, that there's some technology that does exist, or that we might see a third party, source come up with a way for us to use the iPhone as more of a payment device? Because I do think that is a huge tipping point.
Yeah, I think the pieces are mostly there. There's another little bit of circuitry they could use, and they need some stuff on the back end. But so here's the ideal scenario, is that, and really all you have to do is watch the correct movie. You see how this goes. So I get off the plane. I'm in Chicago, and I've gone to my hotel. And I step out of my hotel, and I want to find a restaurant. And I pull up the map, and it tells me here are the restaurants within half a mile. I decide I want to have Thai food because I filtered it that way. I'm walking toward the restaurant. I pull up the menu. I order. When I walk into the restaurant, they say, "Hello, Mr. Green, your table's right here, and here's the cocktail that you ordered." My server comes up and does not introduce himself as John because I don't care. And he puts the food in front of me because I've already ordered it. I eat leisurely. I walk out of the restaurant, and I don't bother paying anybody because my phone has already paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all about transactions and being within locations, seeing where things are, and then purchasing them on the go. So that, and it's all Minority Report. This is really what we're talking about. So instead of, having to pull out a credit card and do all this talking to people, which is just so inconvenient, instead you just go and get the stuff that you want, and as soon as you walk out the door, a little sensor goes ting because you've got that pair of jeans in your bag, and you just leave the place. And let's suppose that Apple takes, credit card companies are getting, 5% per transaction. Let's say Apple takes 1% of every transaction, and let's say there are 3 million transactions per day that are carried out on your iOS device. That's a huge amount of money. And if Apple doesn't get into that business, they're crazy.
Yeah, I think we're all thinking the same thing, that they've got to find a way to do it. I think one of the things, I know, you know, as a global consultant, and I head off to Iraq soon to consult with the Elections Commission there, and I talk, you know, with State Department guests, from Pakistan, and, you know, they're all holding their iPhones, and they've been using them for a long time. I didn't get my iPhone until this year because of Verizon Wireless, and, you know, we've got this wonderful thing called deregulation that seems to have just made things more difficult, or companies that are very powerful like Apple who can decide who we're going to do business with and who we're not. Have you at all looked at any global trends in terms of use of Apple products? Because I know I did a project for Microsoft last year on OEMs, and we included mobile and tablet, And it was really interesting, some feedback out of the UK in particular, in terms of, you know, well, you know, it does these extra things, and yeah, the interface is really nice, but we have, it's so big compared to the phones we had, and they did all of these things anyway. So they had a lot more functionality, I think, to start with. You know, I mean, my husband being English, they did. I mean, there was a lot more functionality, especially in terms of global phones. When I take my iPhone to Iraq, it's not going to work. I'm going to have to power up my BlackBerry Storm, add it to a family plan, get a global plan, just to be able to have a phone to be safe. And that seems really stupid. And it's a U.S., you know, sort of regulatory kind of thing. But it's also been, in this case, Apple was the big decision maker. And I'm just curious if you have covered anything or even have any anecdotal information about use of products in other countries and what that might mean.
Yeah, it's we face a couple of challenges here. One is, as you say, regulation. And every country is different. And so if you go to certain countries in the Middle East, you're not allowed to do certain things because of security, or they want access. So, you know, if you're RIM, you're not allowed to send data out to Canada because they don't want state secrets going across borders. So part of it is regulation. Part of it is proprietary. So Apple wants to protect their plans with AT&T or with Verizon or whoever the home carrier is, so that they make it difficult for you to put a different SIM card in. Because traditionally what people did in the past, they take their cell phone overseas, they walk into the local pharmacy or street vendor, and they just get a SIM card, and they plunk it in there, and it was done. And then you have a local phone number, and you can communicate.
Right.
Apple has made this very difficult so that you have to jailbreak and unlock your phone or pay Apple an enormous amount of money to unlock the thing, which is too bad because, I mean, I'm a proponent of jailbreaking and unlocking for this very reason. If you go overseas, it's ridiculous to pay AT&T these kind of roaming charges, even if you can get on. And if you're in somewhere like Iraq, maybe you can't even communicate, so you have to get a second phone. So it would be nice if we had sort of global regulation of technology, or at least global standards. But I think there's just so many hurdles in the way. Government is certainly one, and then a company protecting their interests is another. And then there's some cultural differences as well. The iPhone doesn't seem to be doing as well in Japan as it does here, and part of it is because of the kind of capabilities they expect from their phone there, where they're doing things like making microtransactions for their devices, and they're not
absolutely.
Doing that. So, and also, technology is so far ahead of governments. I mean, if you know, all you have to do is look at our own representatives in this country and see how far technology has leapt ahead, and then you've got these ancient people in the halls of Congress who believe that the internet is made up of tubes, and these are the people that are making our regulations on how we should allow certain things to happen and not allow other things to happen. You know, and so you're kind of depending on a very slow-moving body to start making decisions about these things, which is unfortunate. So I think, you know, I'm not sure what the solution is to that. I don't know that there is one other than letting government interns make the policy who actually use this stuff and then tell the old men what they should sign off on, and then they can go off and play golf.
Well, I remember the headlines of the first BlackBerry president, so it'll be interesting to see. I mean, obviously, with the kinds of work that I do, you know, I certainly have my eye on what sort of the Gov 2.0 movement is, but I remember the Wired feature right after Obama was elected, and it talked about all of the roadblocks to just make a site, you know, for social advocacy about, around an issue, for example. The same as the way Barack Obama had done it before when he was, you know, a regular civilian trying to get elected to office, which worked. And, you know, and all of the pieces that would be in the way. So I thought they did a great job of kind of, you know, illuminating that, and hopefully people understand it. But I think that in the meantime, I think that you're right. I mean, I think there's lots of questions. You know, there is a lot of countries that want to keep secrets. But then again, when you arrive in Shanghai, everyone knows you get that welcome text welcoming you to Shanghai with some sort of ad about the, you know, or you might walk by or not even know you're going near a McDonald's, and McDonald's is letting you know that they're, you know, 2 meters ahead and, you know, have a special on whatever, kind of taking push notifications to, you know, text. And, you know, that I think is just amazing in a country that you tend to think of as, at least for me, when I went to mainland China, you think, oh, it's going to be closed off and, you know, things aren't going to be allowed. But yet they're very clever about commerce and making sure people are aware of where they are and what they can take advantage of.
Yeah, well, you know, countries like people like to make money. So if there's a profit in it, they tend to look at technology as a solution, you know, more than a way necessarily to help people communicate. But gosh, if they can make money off it, then gung-ho.
Absolutely. Well, then, so back to the products here. You know, you've got the iPhone, iPad, iPod. You know, I've got my big 27-inch Mac. I find myself using my 17-inch MacBook Pro a lot more for whatever reason. And I'm just wondering for you, in terms of convergence, you know, that's, you know, companies don't tend to like that, but you know, maybe you can charge a larger premium. Do you see a convergence of any of these types of products collapsing into one thing? For example, obviously the iPhone is an iPod already, and sort of collapsing those two products into, you know, one item.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think with the iPhone, we have seen a convergence device. I mean, we've been talking about convergence forever, you know, before it actually happened, and people thought, oh, yes, well, the Palm is going to be it, and no, it wasn't. And we're waiting for that big thing to happen, and Apple, interestingly, never said, this is a convergence device, we're here. It just happened, suddenly you turn around and go, oh, this is it. Isn't that surprising? So I think in terms of a pocket device, the iPhone and devices like it are it, you know, whether it's Android or whether it's iPhone. In terms of larger things, people are looking at the iPad and hoping that that will be the convergence device. It can be, sort of, but input is still a problem. It's a perfectly cool virtual keyboard, but without physical feedback, it's not quite the thing that you want to write your novel on. You could if you're a glutton for punishment, and there are other ways to do it, but you can carry a keyboard with it if you want to do that, but it's just not the same as having a laptop. What Apple is doing, I think, is they're looking at kind of the other side of that, and so they're looking at the MacBook Air as becoming that kind of convergence device. So it's light. It's, you know, you carry, you, for example, mentioned carrying around a 17-inch MacBook Pro, which is heavy. It's just enormously heavy. And so,
it is.
You know, if you're into weightlifting, it's great. And it's a wonderful computer, but it's really, really big. But it's great for doing, you know, editing and writing on. The MacBook Air at 11 inches is tiny, or if you want to get the 13-inch, it's still tiny and light. If they were to do something like make it fold back and put a touchscreen on it, maybe that becomes that device. I don't know that Apple would do it because I think that seems a little clumsy for their design ethic. But that may be their solution. It's like, well, if you don't need a lot of input, it's the iPad. If you need more input, it's the MacBook Air. I think that's where Apple's laptops are going to go, is more toward the Air, so lighter, not holding quite as much data, fast as possible. And I think that pretty much takes care of it. And in terms of the iOS, they bring more of those elements into the macOS so that people who grew up on the iOS, who entered the Apple ecosystem via the gateway drug that is the iOS, they then have, you know, they can move comfortably between devices so that it makes sense to them. And then finally, the Apple TV, bring it into the living room and then have it talk to your various devices so that you have this wireless link to entertainment via your other technology.
Yeah, it's getting close, but not quite there. I think I hope what you're saying is absolutely right, and I'm going to trust you for the sake of the fact that you are an expert And I
no, no, I'm just making this up. Just don't.
I'm sure. Now, I'm curious. So now we're celebrating the 25th anniversary Peach Pit Press here, and we've hardly got to talk about your books. I want to ask you how you got involved in the Peach Pit publishing community.
Oh, gosh. Let's see. This was a very long time ago. There was Peach Pit used to put out something called the Macintosh Bible, and indeed it was. And they found every writer who wrote about Macs at the time possible, because these are enormous tomes, and they would try to get people to write little bits of this book. And this, when I started out, I was a musician at the time, and I picked up the Macintosh Bible, and I always wanted to contribute to it because it's sort of like, oh, look, I'm in that universe now if I can do this. And that opportunity finally came along, and so I wrote for them. Very nice people. And then I wrote a games book for them, which forced me to play computer games for 3 months straight. It's a great job when you're 14, but when you're not, after a while, it's just like, please, I want to do something else. So I did that, and that was fine. And then I started doing other things. And mostly it's about the people. A lot of the people who work at Peach Pit now, I've worked with in the past, at Mac User or at Mac Week. And so they're friends of mine, and they're a good company to work for. So I just, whenever the opportunity comes along, I end up doing work for them.
So what book are you most proud of?
Wow. You know, I'm going to say my least best-selling book, or the worst-selling book I've done, which is the Flip Minnow Pocket Guide. And the reason is because the Flip Minnow, and I'm sure you've used one, has one button on it. Yeah, it has a single red button on it that does everything. So to write an entire book about a device that has one button on it is, I thought, was challenging. And it was really fun because it turns out that there's far more that you can do with it. And I got into video editing and other sort of things. So to sit down and try to write a book about something that's easy to use and then find creative ways to go about that. And I'm not saying the book isn't worthwhile, because I think it is, because it does talk about more things like consumer editing of video. But I had a lot of fun writing about it because I had to be creative, and I was funnier in that book than I have been in some of my other ones. I certainly love my iPhone books and my iPod Touch book and my Mac 911 book and the other stuff I've done for them, but that was the one I most enjoy personally writing, and I still go back and read parts of it every once in a while, and I crack up.
So if you had a chance to write a book about music, your training, your love, and it's, you know, it's what you can do with technology, specifically with the Mac, which we've kind of danced around. Have you thought about that?
I did think about it. For Macworld, I do write a lot of the music and technology-based articles. So, and a lot about streaming music and subscription services and that kind of thing. So that's from a music geek. You know, I'm one of those guys that used to haunt record stores back in the day. So I like writing about that stuff. And but in terms of creating music on there, I also work for a company called Lynda.com that does video training. And so I may be doing a music title for them, which would be fun because it gives me a chance to play and show people that you could use a program like GarageBand, and normal people who aren't musicians can bring some music into their life and do creative things with Apple technology. So, yeah, I think at some point I'm going to do something like that. When I was doing my Mac 911 book years ago, as a lark, I was going to put a chapter in about how to play the piano. But somehow my editor thought, no, just going to make us buy more paper for this book, and why would people want that? I thought, I don't know.
Well, I mean, I love the apps. What struck me was the back of a magazine that, I don't know if it was Fast Company or Wired, or it could have even been, it could have even been like, I don't think it was Martha Stewart Living, but it could have even been one of those kinds of titles. But on the back, it basically had the iPhone and a checklist of all of the things you know, amplifier sound. So plug your machine into your iPhone and it suddenly you've got all these amp devices. And basically it went through, I think, seven or around about that number of applications, most free. None of them cost more than $4.99, I don't think. There might have been one that was sort of like a under 40 range that was kind of a do-everything. But I thought that's so interesting that, you know, even from a advertising standpoint, you know, Mac is looking at, you know, reaching out to the music community and saying, hey, here's the way to produce music. Here are even the apps, I mean, you know, down to the granular level that they're not even making, saying, you know, here, go to, these are the experts that create amplifiers. And if you want to, you know, be a DJ, here's, you know, and they're basically endorsing those applications. And like I said, you know, more than half of them were free. What do you think about things like that? Because, I mean, they are filling a sort of education gap. It's almost like an advertorial in a way, rather than a straight ad.
Yeah, they are trying to show people that the kind of things that can do with it. Because again, when you look, you pick up an iOS device, and you know that your phone makes calls, and so you do that, and you text with it, maybe you do some other things with it. Or you have an iPad, and a lot of people pick one up, and go, well, what do I do with this thing? I think it is interesting they focus in on things like this. Apple has long catered to creative types, and particularly graphic artists and musicians. If you go to most professional recording studios now, you're going to find a Mac there, or maybe the whole thing is running Macs and Pro Tools or something like that. And I think that they want to show musicians that you can do some very cool stuff with these small devices that doesn't cost much. I mean, I've been playing music long enough that I remember spending $5,000 on a synthesizer. And now I can get an app that does far more than that for $2. And you can have a recording studio in your Mac that does things that you would used to spend $75 an hour for, or $125 at your local music studio. So the price of this technology has just plummeted to the point where anybody can make music, whether it's, you know, stringing together loops to be a DJ, or whether they're, and I apologize to DJs, but being a real musician where you actually play an instrument and can record and manipulate audio in interesting ways. So I credit Apple for bringing that kind of power to any number of creative industries, and certainly the music industry is one.
How has it touched your life as a musician, if at all?
I'm sorry, I missed that.
So how has it touched your life as a musician, if at all, the iPhone or any Mac applications? I think people, you know, as a personality that is so, you know, so known for use of Macintosh products, I think people would die to know what it is, you know, for your probably first love, if I don't want to put words in your mouth, but maybe your first love, you know, and how it's influenced that.
Oh, it's huge. The only reason I got a Mac in the first place is because a friend of mine who was in my band showed me a copy of a program called Performer that was made by Mark of the Unicorn in 1986. And I saw how I could record my synthesizer into this thing using MIDI, and I was sold. I said, I want that. And I got it, and I just became a Mac freak because of it. Since then, I use GarageBand routinely to write songs. I still have a band, so I pull together songs we're working on. I put them in GarageBand. I take them to the band and say, this is what I envision for the guitar part. This is the drum part here. I also do podcasting for Macworld, so I use GarageBand for editing and recording our podcasts. And just when I'm dinking around, I will sometimes fire up a copy of a program called Band in a Box. So I get this little mini band to accompany my noodling or record what I'm doing. I've recorded a couple of albums, and I've done it all using Apple technology. So it's a huge, huge deal because I can do this for the price of the technology that I already own rather than having to go to a recording studio. And again, Apple has made deals with companies like Apogee so that you can get great sounding audio interfaces that don't cost a fortune, and I can mic my piano at home and come up with professional quality results, and I can go through a company and get my albums on iTunes. So it's made an enormous difference. And particularly artists I follow now who are using Kickstarter to fund their projects and producing wonderful music without the help of labels. So I think that that Apple has had a huge role to play in all of that.
Absolutely. I think iTunes, you touched on. The one thing that I would say, if since it's my show, I'll say something. I wish Ping were better. I wish they hadn't announced it and just sort of let us all play with it before they announced it, because I don't feel like it's fully baked, and it's kind of annoying in a lot of ways. But that's a side note, because I love the product so much, and I just wish that it kind of was, to me, it was announced to be different, and when I actually saw it, I was like, really? This is it? So I, you know, that was one area where I feel like they probably could push out a lot more, but know that they don't really have to, because we'll find the products out there. But it's great to hear using iTunes as a distribution platform, and this show will be on iTunes, as many of our listeners that will be listening to this on iTunes already know. So, you know, as we come to the end of our time, which we've gone way over, and I've enjoyed every second of talking with you, I can think of a million more things I'd love to chat with you about. What final comments can you share regarding the Peach Pit team as we celebrate this 25th anniversary of Peach Pit Press?
You know, when all is said and done, you know, and you sort of go beyond putting together a book and going through the painful editing process and getting books out and arguing about contracts and all this stuff, they're just really nice people. And I wouldn't work with them if they weren't. And that's generally how I've carried on through life. I work with people that I like. And if I don't like them, I stop working for them, because who needs the headaches? So, you know that when you're picking up a Peach Pit product, and it sounds like a terrible ad, but it's true, that the people who put that thing together and put it in your hands are really nice people. They're the kind of people you could go out and have a beer with, or if you don't drink beer, you could have coffee with them. And if you don't drink coffee, then life is just not worth living. but you can have tea, I suppose. No, they're just good folks. And so I support what they do.
And you mentioned a couple of people earlier. Anyone else you'd love to give a shout-out to?
Oh, at Peach Pit?
Yeah.
I would give a shout-out to Cliff Colby, who's used to be at MacWeek and has been my editor for a long time. And Nancy Peterson, who I worked with at both MacUser and MacWorld, is one of my favorite people on earth. I haven't actually done many Peach Pit projects with her, because she's in a different unit, but she's great. She's great. So, and everybody I've met at Peach Pit has always been nice. They're in Berkeley, and, you know, so they're kind of cool, and they're good. So that's what I have to say
awesome.
About Peach Pit.
Yeah, it always makes you think of Jack Kerouac and some of the beats that were renting places in Berkeley when they were writing various things, and, you know, being near San Francisco, it's a very cool location. Chris, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the special show.
Well, thank you. I've really enjoyed this.
I think our listeners have too, and I'll let you get on with your day.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks so much. And again, folks, you can learn more about the history of Peach Pit Press on its website at peachpit.com. Again, thanks to Chris for joining us on this special show celebrating the 25th anniversary of Peach Pit Press. We hope you enjoyed the program. Please feel free to embed, download, or otherwise share the show. And tomorrow, our special Peach Pit 25th anniversary shows conclude with my interview with publisher Nancy Aldrich Runzel. That's tomorrow again at noon Pacific. I hope you'll join us, and thank you so much for listening. Have a great day.